Welcome to Signs of the Times, a look at recent world events from around our kitchen table.
You're with us for another Signs of the Times podcast. This week, it's just the three of us, myself, Joe, Henry and Scott, and we want to talk about the economy. We've talked about the economy before, as some of our readers may, or listeners may remember, but this week we want to talk about the economy in terms of a financial collapse or an economic collapse like last time, but we want to focus a little bit more on the direct effects on the population and look at some maybe past historical evidence of financial collapses and the effects that those collapses had on the populations. And well, we're just going to talk free and easy. So
grab your smokes and have a seat.
If you don't smoke, you know, grab a glass of whiskey. If you don't drink, then you should.
And what the hell are you doing listening to us?
If you don't drink or smoke, then you haven't been listening. Because by now, you should be on the verge of a breakdown.
The topic for this week's podcast came from an article that a reader sent into us. The article is called Post-Soviet Lessons for a Post-American Century. It's written by Dmitry Orlov, and it was published on the From the Wilderness website. Now, From the Wilderness, as our readers may know, is one of those websites that's promoting the idea of peak oil. And the article is a comparison of the economic crash and the effects of it on the average citizen in the Soviet Union in the 90s and a projected economic crash that might happen in the United States in the near future. And, of course, according to Orlov and the people at From the Wilderness, this will be due to peak oil, meaning that we are at the end of the oil reserves, and when they run out, modern civilization will start to collapse because we won't have the basic energy and fuel to power it. Now, we are not in agreement with the idea that oil is running out. We don't think that it's a fossil fuel. We don't think that it's been proven that it's a fossil fuel. Nevertheless, that doesn't mean that the powers that be won't use the idea of peak oil in order to stage manage and manipulate a crisis. They'll turn off the taps and they'll say, oh, sorry, folks, the oil has run out. Wherein, in fact, that won't be the case. It'll just be their way of turning the screws even stronger. But whether the crisis is from peak oil or from something else, and there are any number of candidates for that, be it terrorist attacks or so-called terrorist attacks or earth changes such as earthquakes and volcanoes, the article is interesting because it gives an interesting look at what happened in the Soviet Union and compares it to the United States, looking for differences between the two. He points out, you know, in a certain way, it was the economic organization under communism made it easier for the people to weather the economic storm after the collapse because of the way society had been organized.
Yeah, I mean, he draws a contrast, obviously, between the way society was organized in communist Russia or post-communist Russia and the way society is organized at the minute in modern-day America. Obviously, in the differences here between capitalism and communism, essentially the state was essentially a nanny state, but in terms of an economic collapse, the shock of a crash in the economy was lessened to a large degree because of essentially the state control over pretty much everything in terms of housing and transport, etc., so that these services, let's call them, were not taken away from the people as they would be in a capitalist society.
Exactly. The people in the Soviet Union didn't own their homes or weren't mortgaged to the banks for their homes, so that when the economy collapsed, there were no banks to foreclose on mortgages, so people didn't lose their homes. As well, there was a much lower percentage ownership of cars and a higher integration of public services, public transportation, and the public transportation also continued to function during the economic crisis.
And Orlov notes that that even the worst gasoline shortages that occurred resulted in only minor inconveniences to people, and he talks about, you know, basically two times a year when they needed to go buy the seeds, when they needed to take their harvested crops and sell them, and, you know, that was pretty much it. And you compare that to the U.S. where he goes into great detail and actually sort of humorous detail about the structure of the traffic system, the highway system in the U.S., and he talks about the traffic engineers and how they seem to want to design roads to make people drive around in circles and waste gas.
And if you look at the way the cities are laid out in the Soviet Union, the central planners liked having people grouped together, so things were highly concentrated. There weren't the same kind of suburbs based on the automobile that there are in the United States. So were the peak oil manipulation to manifest and the tap turned off and people not have any gas for their cars, how would cities function? How would people be able to get to stores, even if there were anything, if there was anything left to buy in the stores? The transportation system would fall apart.
And as we've mentioned before, there wouldn't be anything left to buy in the stores because most goods in the U.S. are transported by truck, and of course that requires diesel fuel. And of course there's a rail system, but you're talking again about generally electric trains, which are powered by diesel generators. So again, you know, fuel shortage, that means no goods are delivered. And of course these are privately owned companies, because most of the transportation companies in the U.S., whether it's local buses or train systems or even the national bus companies like Greyhound, these are not public companies.
Yeah, and the way the capitalist economy and capitalist companies, corporations are organized, the board and the management has the power to lay off everybody right away and to close the companies almost overnight. That didn't happen in the Soviet Union because of the central planning. People continued working even if they weren't receiving their salaries regularly.
Yeah, which brings us to the point of labor in the Soviet Union versus in the U.S. Orlov writes that in the Soviet Union, basically the majority of the people were skilled labor. The Soviet Union exported all kinds of things. In addition to oil, you know, weapons and industrial machinery, and, you know, you compare this to the U.S. where basically manufacturing jobs are being sent overseas to Mexico, India, in terms of especially software engineering and that sort of thing. And so what you're left with is this sort of skeleton, which consists of basically the rich executives. And so he comments that this whole process has become known as the brain drain, where, in essence, America's extraction of talent from foreign lands has benefited the U.S., at least up until now, but has obviously not benefited these other countries. And as we've shown recently on the science page, this policy, so to speak, seems to be beginning to reverse.
And then he speculates that were there to be a severe economic crisis in the United States, these highly trained people from around the world would return to their countries to escape it.
You know, one of the interesting points that he makes is that when he visited Russia during this economic collapse, he noted that it was the middle classes who seemed to be suffering the most. He kind of made the comment that they were scavenging in the trash and the dumps to try and piece together a part of their lives, you know, and as part of their lives that they lost. And it's kind of interesting in terms of when we look at America and what might happen in America, because in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, when we saw maybe in microcosm similar effects to an economic collapse, we saw that it was the lower classes who, in response to this crisis where there was no food and no jobs and etc., they for this period of days were essentially like the end of the world, or the end of their normal lives had come. It was the lower classes who tended to band together and network and try and sort things out for themselves, which obviously the U.S. government at the time, in the stories that we carried at the time, the U.S. government tried to clamp down on this and prevent it from actually happening. So what we're really saying here is that, while we're not trying to suggest that communism, this isn't about communism being espoused over capitalism or anything like that, but simply to draw the comparison and to look at the foreseeable effects and the big fall that a lot of people in America will be in for in the event of an economic collapse, because they are so immersed in an entire capitalist system where they have all of the perks, where they're completely dependent on their lives in terms of their SUVs and their subscription at the local sports club and their jobs, and their entire lives are caught up in this in all of these, in this consumerism and having all of these things. And when all of those things are taken away, well, then people's entire their basis for reality, or what they believe to be their reality, has been completely removed.
Their whole,
of course,
identity.
Yeah, and of course that isn't their reality. I mean, that is their reality, but it's not the reality. They've been force-fed this reality and have been forced to believe that this is what it's all about. This is the important thing. And the thing they don't realize is that this can be so easily and so quickly removed.
We haven't even touched on the question of violence, which is somewhat endemic to the American society, back from the mythos of the Wild West up to today, with the close binding of the idea of the right to carry a firearm with political freedom in some way. American culture is rife with violence, and what's going to happen when all of these stops of society are pulled out and people are left to fend for themselves? Orlov also points out that Soviet society was much less mobile than American society, and people in neighborhoods tend to live there for a very long time, if not their entire lives, and so everybody kind of knew one another. If it was only through the faces and walking the streets, you'd recognize one another, so that when times were difficult, there was a social system there, a social net, a network for people to rely upon. This is also the case in apartments where you'd have multiple generations of families living together, which is quite the extreme from what we see in the United States with the single family dwelling and the basic economic unit of the mother, father, and 2.5 kids.
Yeah, so the thing we have to remember in all of this is that, as Roosevelt is alleged to have said, nothing in politics happens by accident. If it happens that way, then it was meant to happen that way. And we can maybe take that a little bit further and suggest that it's not just politics, because, well, maybe it is politics, because, you know, the word politics it comes from the Greek word for citizens. So essentially, he could have been saying that whatever happens in the lives of the citizens anywhere on the planet doesn't happen by accident. If it happens, it happens because it was planned to happen that way. And the thing is that in terms of the economic collapse in Russia and the preceding kind of fall of communism of the Soviet Union, a few years and even a few months before that happened, very few people, if anyone, in terms of the ordinary citizen, could have foreseen that or would have expected that. If you had suggested that to them at the time, that things were about to collapse in terms of the entire social order and political structure, they would have laughed at you. So these things happen overnight, essentially. So it bears kind of stressing that, again, in the words of Roosevelt, these things are planned to happen, and they can and do happen overnight, not by pure chance, but because they are planned that way.
Yeah, and getting back to what Henry was talking about the differences in the cultures and the societies, you know, between the U.S. as it is now and the Soviet Union before this economic collapse, money in the Soviet Union, as Orlov writes, didn't have the same value in terms of, you know, I mean, in the U.S. now, it's you know, money is everything. You know, I mean, money is power, money is social status, and in the Soviet Union, it was, you know, he writes that, you know, if your neighbors or your friends fell on hard times, it was perfectly normal, you know, for people to just, you know, spread the wealth basically, because everyone had these jobs and everyone had like a fixed income and all these, you know, normal everyday items had fixed costs, and it was just, you know, sharing.
Money didn't have the same meaning for people.
Yeah. And
it was a means to an end, not an end in itself. The idea of just having money for the sake of having money was not the point. The point was that if money was used for feeding yourself, and there was no real necessity to kind of have vast amounts of money to. Obviously, this was obviously regulated as well by the whole idea of communism, because you know the state controlled wages and jobs, etc., etc.
I mean, the Soviet Union wasn't exactly a communist state. I mean, it was more like a welfare state that was run by an elitist group. And I mean, it's when you think about it, it's pretty much the exact same thing as the U.S. I mean, of course, you have this difference, you know, the difference in terms of the way that people value money, and the materialism in the U.S. is so much greater than in the former Soviet Union. But at the same time, you have this identical structure of the power elite who have the wealth. They have the political clout, and you know they pull all the strings. And I mean, that's essentially the same. What's not the same is that in the U.S., basically everything is, as Orlov notes, nicely set up to make an economic crash far more miserable.
Yeah, and it's that's in terms of it having always been the way of there being a political elite that controls things, regardless of the type of society that or the type of government that they are ruling over. This is very true, because we can see that from history, that it's been a small group of power elite who have simply used these various forms of in recent years anyway have used these various forms of government, these supposedly opposing forms of government, i.e. communism and capitalism or socialism. And the thing is that while that for the people that might be an obvious difference, that there's a difference in their lifestyles, etc., the fact is that at the top level, where these societies or the forms of government are being orchestrated, there is no difference there. We're talking simply about a global elite who have always had the same goal, which was to rule over the people in whatever way they saw fit, or that in whatever way best fit the times that were in it.
Which brings us back to the subject that we have talked about quite often in the past, and that we will no doubt repeat often in the future, the question of psychopaths and ponerology. It's clear to us that both the capitalist system and the communist system are psychopathic systems, but don't think that an economic crash is going to somehow save us from this. If we read the descriptions of what happened in the Soviet Union that Orlov gives, we see that there is very, very fertile ground for the psychopath to maintain power. As he says, it's not a civilization that collapses so much as an economic system, and as it collapses, in the crevices of the crumbling structure, you get new economic forms emerging, one of which at the beginning is barter, and the barter is based on people having hoarded or stockpiled consumer items that people need, such as soap, razors, toilet paper, these kinds of things, that then become, they take on a value that they don't have in normal society. They become more valuable than money. But the kind of people that are able to maneuver in this kind of situation are going to be the kind of people who only think about themselves, who have no conscience.
Well, yeah, I mean, we had a good example of that in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, where we've already mentioned that these people who from New Orleans who banded together and tried to kind of make their lot a little better were attacked essentially by the National Guard under the instructions of the U.S. government, and they there was another incident where you had, I think it was a mayor of one of the local towns who was
blocking the bridge so that people couldn't leave New Orleans, wouldn't let them into his town.
Well, yeah, there was him, but there was another guy I was thinking of. I think it might have actually been in New Orleans. We'll have to look it up. But there was, I think it was an official of New Orleans who had realized that members of FEMA or representatives of FEMA had come down and cut his communication lines to essentially the outside world, just arbitrarily with no explanation. And he had to post one of his a policeman, an armed guard or a policeman on the door with orders to shoot anyone that came along and tried to cut the communication lines again. This is an example of the thinking and the type of people that Henry's talking about that spring up and see this suffering of other people as an opportunity for them to capitalize on. And so in the event of an economic collapse, people need to be aware that there are going to be people out there who are going to be watching you, for example, the ordinary person in the street who is maybe concerned about his neighbors who are in a bad way or who need help, et cetera, et cetera. And they're going to be doing everything they can to profit from that situation and screw you over.
So the picture looks rather grim indeed. And despite all the comparisons that Orlov makes at the end of his article, he makes some conclusions that are, well, rather optimistic.
Feel-good conclusions for his American audience, we'd call them.
Yeah, and he talks about how Americans are, you know, they're far better at communal living than Russians ever were. They're generous, and they have an altruistic impulse to give to other people. And I mean, I'm American, and I lived there for a good many years, and I would have to say that, you know, my personal experience and I mean, from, you know, talking to everyone I knew, that basically that's just not true. And
well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, if you've been taught and if you've learned that, for example, your SUV is a major part of your life, and that you really, really need
major
it, and
you're part of who you are.
Yeah, and that you've come to exactly see it as part of yourself almost. Well, when you no longer have that SUV, or you no longer can run that SUV, you're going to tend towards kind of being concerned about having that back. And we're just using SUV here as an example here, but there's other frills that we could cite of capitalism that are completely insignificant in the grand scheme of things that people are going to be extremely concerned about. And the thing is that this
frills to even people's jobs.
Well, yeah. And the thing is that the idea that people who have been so kind of programmed in this way would immediately turn around and become altruistic and not be concerned about getting fuel for their SUV and would possibly, you know, not rob their neighbor of fuel or try to screw him over. And this is, again, we talked about people, you know, who would be altruistic. There may well be, there certainly will be people who will be motivated to care for their suffering neighbors, etc. But there will be a lot of people who, because of the nature of the capitalism in the U.S. and the fact that it has been directed by a bunch of psychopaths, a lot of people in the U.S. and also in Western Europe, but we're talking specifically here about the U.S. and an economic collapse there. A lot of those people have been essentially psychopathized in a way in their thinking and in their attitudes by the people who have governed them and have set the social norms and the social policies and what people need and what they don't need, etc., etc. And none of it it's all well and good while it's all available and freely available for at least a portion of the American people. But when that's taken away, I mean, people are going to be in shock. And to avoid that shock, or to at least lessen that shock somewhat, there needs to be a serious restructuring of perspective before that happens.
Americans consider that their country is the most advanced, the most free, the most everything. And when the collapse comes, they will be given a very rude awakening as to the facts. There are many signs that we talk about, we have been talking about for many years, such as September 11th and the legislation such as the Patriot Act that was brought in after that. The signs are there for the people who want to look and see what is really truly going on. But most people, it's really going to take a tremendous shock such as that as we're discussing tonight to wake them up.
And what we're trying to do is give some kind of forewarning to these people, to you, the listener, if you're in America, about what you can do to avoid this tremendous shock, or as we say, to at least lessen this tremendous shock, and to start to sit up and take notice of what's going on, and to look at what your life is and look at what your priorities are in your life. Because what's the point in being so concerned with so many kind of material goods and material frills when they may well be taken away in the blink of an eye, basically. I mean, it serves no one to be so wrapped up in believing that they need these things when all the signs point to the fact that someone is planning to take them away.
And here Orlov does give a hint of a possible way out when he discusses the difference of reactions among the people who were very, very identified with the Soviet system and those people who had a more, you know, we don't really care about the whole thing, who weren't identified with it. And he talks about Dauphinism as a dominant ideology. And he says Dauphinism means, kind of in a rough translation, not giving a rat's ass. It's the people who, even though they were highly educated, would take very, very humble jobs so that when they left their job, they'd go and do what was really important, which was talking with their friends, exchanging, and just sitting and watching life. And it's this capacity to be able to just sit back and watch what is going on, not identifying with what you're seeing, that is going to enable people to have the flexibility and the fluidity to be able to respond as this crisis unfolds.
Yeah, and you're talking here about responding in a way that is essentially the complete opposite of what American capitalist society has taught people, which is to network in a way that is somewhat altruistic, and to you know, it's almost like communism as it should have been, the idea of people working together for the good of the people that are working together. But of course, we like to reiterate that, you know, we're not espousing communism here, but simply using it as an example.
And we're also not espousing, you know, pitching your DVD player in the garbage can and burning your SUV. I mean, you know, the point is that, you know, a lot of people send us emails and say, oh, you're so negative, and oh, why are you focusing on all this bad stuff? And, you know, I mean, the point, as Henry says, is, you know, the signs are all there, and, you know, I mean, you know, we can see what's coming, and when you read an article like this one by Orlov, you know, you have an opportunity, and, you know, it's an opportunity to, if you can't prepare financially, and I mean, you know, how do you, you know, prepare financially? I mean, he makes a few suggestions in the article, you know, related to the bartering that Henry talked about. I think he recommends getting boxes and putting goods that would be tradable and packing them in boxes, nitrogen packing, you know, which, of course, everyone can just get a tank of nitrogen, you know, no problem.
Yeah, so we're just talking about being smart here. We're not talking about, like, stocking up for the end of the world, and because we're not suggesting that it's going to be the end of the world, but we're talking about being smart and simply taking precautions, foreseeing, recognizing the signs and foreseeing the potential disaster that's coming down the line, and taking some reasonable measures to lessen your suffering. And of course, as we've said, one of the major things that you can do to lessen your suffering is to sit up and take notice and realign your perspective.
Yeah, it's you know, you can, in a sense, psychologically immunize yourself from a great deal of the shock if you're, you know, seeing the signs now and you're thinking about it and you're preparing not just in a physical way but in an emotional and mental and psychological way, and it'll be much easier to survive.
We've mentioned the idea of peak oil, that we don't believe that peak oil is a reality, but that it may well be used to precipitate or to as a plausible excuse for an economic collapse. But there's also the idea that peak oil is quite closely tied to the 9/11 event, because one of its major exponents is Mike Rupert, on whose website this article appeared. And Mike Rupert was obviously a major 9/11 investigator, and then did this complete turnaround where he kind of decided that, you know, people shouldn't investigate 9/11 anymore because peak oil was coming. Now, that was a very, very smart, if you're dumb enough, it was a very smart way to sidetrack the whole 9/11 investigation and to kind of ramp up the fear factor and scare people away from investigating 9/11. But there's also the possibility, and there's also any number of other ways that an economic collapse could be precipitated, one of them being the all-too-common terror attacks these days. Another major terror attack in the U.S. could also be used as a plausible excuse to send the economy into freefall. There's also natural cataclysms, earthquakes, another hurricane, or even a meteorite impact, but maybe that's later on down the line.
And furthermore, you know, say you go and you prepare yourself physically and mentally and emotionally and however you need to prepare yourself for the economic crash, and nothing happens. Say we're totally wrong about, you know, all the seeing the signs and all this stuff. You know, say we're dead wrong. Economic crash never happens. Well, you know, what have you lost by preparing?
Well, exactly. I mean, because there's if an economic collapse doesn't happen, the steps that we're proposing that people take need to be taken anyway, because what we're talking about here is sitting up, getting your nose out of your Xbox or DVD player, or, you know, out of your neighbor's wife's chest. And well, this can only be a good thing, because we're talking about reality here and the fact that regardless of whether there's an economic collapse or not, people are completely living in a world of illusion in terms of their priorities or what they hold dear in life and what they think life is all about. Because you can rest assured that if an economic collapse doesn't occur, something else is going to occur. That's one thing we can say with certainty, that something major is going to happen over the next few months or next year. And whatever it is, it's not going to be good, and everybody is going to need their wits about them, and they're going to need to be sitting up and looking beforehand at this coming along so it doesn't slap you in the face just like that.